So, Mr. Marshall, will you please call the case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Jessen, Judge Koch, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case A21-0544 in the matter of the public waters restoration order issued to Timothy Machi.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This hearing is being recorded. It will be posted on our website. You each will have 15 minutes to argue your case, with Mr. Earhart having 5 minutes for rebuttal if he chooses to use it. Since it is being recorded, I'd ask that you each introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument for purposes of the record. And with that, Mr. Earhart, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Thank you.
William Earhart, on behalf of Timothy Machi, I want to address a few issues. The briefs were quite extensive in this case, but there's a number that are points that need to be emphasized. And I want to address first the comment by the state, the DNR, that the Machis built a full-blown road, which is inconsistent with the evidence. And in fact, there was no testimony by the state relating to the size or height of this road that predated its construction. A little history here is go back. The original road was built in the late 70s and earlys based upon the testimony. Mr. Yost and other landowners used heavy equipment. By 2003, the land was purchased by the Machis. There was testimony that at the time they purchased it, the roads 1 and 2 were used regularly with motor vehicles, including trucks, all-terrain vehicles, etc. In 2009, there was a fire that engulfed a large area of surrounding the Machi property.
Mr. Earhart, I'm sorry to interrupt you so early in your argument, but you are talking about something that I had questions about.
Sure.
In particular, I'm wondering about the evidence in the record that shows how the trails were created. Now, you said that the previous owners used heavy equipment to create the trails. You're calling them roads, but it's trail 1 and 2 that we're talking about.
Yeah, and you know,
and then also, what were they like when your client bought the property? Had they just been mowed, cleared of brush? Had any thing been laid down on them? I'm just curious what the record says about what they were like when your client bought them.
The client's testimony, both Mr. Machi and his son, elaborated that they were elevated above the other surrounding the surface, and that they were mowed, and that when they purchased it, they had talked to the prior owner, who showed them how to maintain the property, because he had been maintaining it, and he had actually a gravel mix and I believe some limestone that he had left. So these were, you know, maintained prior to the Machi's purchase, and then when they purchased it, they routinely maintained it. And there's no evidence in the record by the state that they were not attended to on a regular basis.
Thank you. And when you say maintained, I know that your clients testified that they mowed them twice a year, at least.
Correct. And it also stated that they put limestone and gravel mix routinely, as the previous owners had done, so that, you know, if there was any washouts, because they use these regularly, either by foot, you know, four-wheelers or vehicles, motor vehicles. So
What you're saying is that you believe they were grandfathered in for purposes of use and maintenance by the fact that they have existed for so long. Does the law support that when we're talking about public waters as opposed to something like a setback on a lakeshore property or something of that sort?
Well, if I can explain that, the statute talks about prohibitions and the rules, and that's what we cited as the 6115. That's the controversy here. It's maintenance allowed for existing conditions. And it's our position that you can't interpret this any other way. And one example that we gave in there is, what happens if 1983 you built a driveway across some public, now public land, and you had a flash flood and it washed it out? Is the state saying you can't maintain that? That was a natural event, and it's in public water, and you're done. You know, and this is similar to here, except it didn't happen as a flash flood. Over time, this road was built in wetlands and likely slowly sank, but the major event that caused the disruption was the public use of it in firefighting in 2009. They drove not only, you know, heavy trucks, water trucks, vehicles, all kinds of equipment, hundreds of times across these roads. That evidence was not contradicted. That cut up the road. It sank it, and it needed repair. And the testimony was uncontradicted, that the use of these roads, these paths, in fact, saved the Machi's property, their home. So that's critical to them. They want those things preserved, and rightly so. I mean, it's reasonable.
Mr. Earhart, if I may jump in, because this is one of the things that kind of struck me about this case. I could see a reading of the record that would say that your clients were maintaining a roadway, you know, at least consistent with, sometimes more than it had been maintained by previous owners, and without thinking that they were filling in kind of arguably a, you know, public water. But then when I went back and looked at the Christensen case, you know, it seems to say, look, we're not, I mean, because, and I think part of what you're saying is our clients didn't, there was no notice of this. They didn't know. They were trying to just do what's done before. And yet Christensen seems to say, well, but we're not going to wait till everyone knows about the inventory process or what is public waters. We're not requiring that. So help me understand how you would have me deal with that case.
Well, the Christensen case, you remember, in one of the factors was that, as I recall it, the ditch hadn't been maintained for years. And I think is a huge distinguishable fact from the current instance. And the other distinguishable fact is that they, you know, wanted to drain it so that you could use the land. Well, you got two things here. This was regular maintained from to the time it was built to the current time. And secondly, is that the maintenance was for purposes of, you know, safety, preserving the Machi's home. It's undisputed that this property was used as a fire line during 2009 and also to operate and bring water to the various fire hotspots. And they stayed there for more than a week. The Machis testified firsthand that they observed, you know, that they sprinkled it down, and the firemen said, if this roads and this were not there, your house wouldn't be there.
If you could, Mr. Earhart, one other question I had dealt with just the interpretation of Rule 6115, the rule about filling in public waters. And yes. I understand what you're saying about kind of, isn't there a distinction between constructing a roadway or pathway and maintaining it? Okay, I understand your statutory argument there, but what about the phrase which the commissioner seemed to rely on, or to facilitate land transportation? I mean, isn't it reasonable that that was, could be what was going on here?
Well, you know, they used the word facilitate, If they didn't want to have maintenance, why didn't they use the word maintenance? We, you know, elaborated that in the brief, but common sense tells me that if you have an existing road and there wasn't any evidence of whether this road, when built, or pathway, you know, was, you know, above the ordinary high water level mark or not. Just uncertain. The state never said one way or another or provided any evidence. Our position is that, based upon lack of testimony from the state, that and objection, this road was put in legally and maintained legally throughout its existence. The question is if you have a road and then it sinks slowly over time and then goes below the ordinary high water level, do you have a right to bring it up to the above the ordinary high water level?
Mr. Earhart, I have two questions with regard to that. On page 34 of your brief, you say the undisputed testimony is that these trails before improvement were higher than the surrounding ordinary high water levels. Can you point to the evidence in the record that supports that assertion? I didn't see anything that definitely showed what the ordinary high water levels were at that time.
The only testimony would be is that there was heavy equipment and this property, the roads were built, were elevated significantly above the existing land. And on top of the roads, the only aquatic or vegetation was non-aquatic. And that was from the time that my clients purchased it to the current time, and at least known or by the prior owner that the only existence of vegetation was non-aquatic.
So then that brings me to my second question. In the DNR introduced aerial photos showing that Trail 1 becomes visible in 2017, but that trail isn't visible in the earlier photos.
Well, in my observation of them, you can see them. The one thing is that in 2016, the grass hadn't grown back, so they're clearly visible. But earlier, in fact, when we had the administrative hearing internally back in 2019, he commented that the testimony was consistent with the pictures, that there were trails that you could observe, going back then. You got to remember, if you take aerial photographs and you it's all vegetation, it's difficult to see differences. But we also stipulated that these trails, with the state existed prior to the Machi's purchasing it.
I also wanted to understand more fully your constitutional argument,
sure,
your due process arguments. And I'm wondering, is there a particular rule or statute that you're asking this court to declare unconstitutional, or are you arguing a facial or as applied challenge?
Well, I think it's more the applied. You have a vague statute on public water. It's on divine property. Public waters can change over time. In this instant case, they had an inventory in 1984. It was never updated, and they don't even use it anymore. And this Arcus, which they claim they went to, even though they say it's available to the public, there's no instructions on it. How would one know, whether you're in, public water based upon all of these items? And then, you have to remember that there were four trails that they were complaining about originally, and three and four, they were determined to be above the ordinary high water level. So they didn't do or challenge those. So it's only the two on one and two. And I mean, the clients only did what, and it's uncontroverted testimony, is bring them up to what they were before, you know, the decline, but primarily that occurred in 2009. And the size and shape were consistent with what existed then. And that is to allow a vehicle to traverse on it. Now, the state says that it looks like full-blown road is their terms. I mean, if you take a look at the pictures, there's not two-way traffic that can pass on it. The picture showed that, consistent with the Monchi's testimony, it was accessible by a motor vehicle or heavy equipment, and that's what it was like and what it is now. And therefore, you know, there wasn't any testimony to support that this is some huge undertaking that changed the character of the roadway or pathway.
Thank you, Mr. Earhart. Your 15 minutes is up and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you. Mr. Farrell.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Pete Farrell. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This court should affirm the restoration order that the DNR issued to Mr. Machi and require him to remove the fill that he has placed in an Anoka County public water. Mr. Machi has raised a slew of arguments on appeal, some of which he touched on this morning, but I'd like to focus the court's attention on two key points that show why the DNR's decision should be affirmed. First, this court should affirm because the unrefuted expert evidence shows that the roads are below the ordinary high water level of the basin and therefore within the DNR regulatory jurisdiction. And second, this court should affirm because substantial evidence in the record supports the DNR's determination that Mr. Machi placed fill in a public water without a permit for purposes prohibited by state water law. Let me turn
You know, Mr. Earhart said, I wrote this down so I think I've got this correctly, but this case comes down to the issue is if you have a road that sinks over time to below the high water mark, does a property owner have a right to raise the road? And I'm sure on rebuttal he'll tell me if I got that wrong. So my question to you, and I know you may quibble with this, did it sink over time or all that, so feel free to take this as a hypothetical, but is the DNR's position that yes, if you have a road that sinks over time to below the high water level, the property owner does not have the right to raise the road. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that's a fair characterization of the DNR's position. And I won't quibble with the hypothetical. I just want to, as a threshold matter, state that I don't agree that on these facts that hypothetical is in play.
Okay. But taking the hypothetical. I set that aside. So just answer me if that had happened. Okay, that property owner has a road that sinks over time to below the high water level. The property owner, from your perspective, does not have the right to raise the road. Is that correct?
No. So I think it would depend, Your Honor. I think that in the Christensen decision, which is the leading public waters decision, the Supreme Court has left open the door, at least left open the possibility that in an appropriate case, the non-conforming use doctrine would kick in. Now, there hasn't been a case where that's been applied and it doesn't apply here. But if you look at page 614 of the Christensen decision, that door is at least open. That situation that you're positing, the sort of parade of horribles that Mr. Machi fears, the sinking driveway situation, a couple of points on that. First of all, the PWI, the public waters inventory, has been in place for nearly four decades. And this spate of sinking driveway cases is not a problem that has manifested itself during that time period. But if the stars did align and there were a situation where you had a driveway that, due to changing climatic conditions, did somehow sink, I think there would be two safety valves to get at the concern you're raising. One safety valve would be the DNR's enforcement discretion. That's not an insignificant safety valve here. The DNR did take and does take a close look at any restoration order that it actually issues. The second safety valve would be the one identified by the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Christensen decision, which in the appropriate case, there may be an opportunity for the nonconforming use doctrine to apply if you had a sinking driveway that truly did pre-exist or that clearly was above ordinary high water level and sunk over time. That doctrine on the facts you're positing might apply. But Your Honors, that is not this case. And I guess let me start there before I sort of shift to the jurisdictional issue and just talk a little bit about the record, which was the main focus of Mr. Machi's presentation today. This is not a case about mere maintenance of pre-existing trails. If that were, if these were just mere footpaths or mode trails, that we wouldn't be here today. What the record shows and what the DNR's expert hydrologist testified to at trial and what the ALJ found at the reflected ALJ's findings of paragraphs 14 through 24 is that there were significant material changes to these roads that are reflected in the aerial images that were introduced into evidence at the hearing. So with respect to Road 1, if you look at the aerial images from 2008, there is nothing visible where Road 1 is when you look at those aerial images. Fast forward to 2017, there is a full-blown road, one that you can drive a pickup truck on, according to DNR's conservation officer, and Mr. Machi himself admits you can drive motor vehicles on, that's not visible in 2008. With respect to Road 2, the DNR's expert hydrologist testified how that when you look at the 2008 images, again, images well after Mr. Machi purchased the property, you see a black, what he surmised to be a mode trail. The hydrologist testified that the black trail to him signified a saturated condition based on the nature of the property. Again, fast forward to 2017, you've got a road with classified gravel. That's why the DNR was notified by the Coon Creek Watershed District of this potential violation. That's why the DNR investigated this potential violation. And that's why the DNR issued the restoration order to Mr. Machi. Now, let me circle back to the jurisdictional issue because I do want to clear up any confusion on this point. And that has to do with the ordinary high water level. That's Mr. Machi's lead argument in his brief. This is really a jurisdictional argument. It takes a couple different forms. He focuses on, I think it's fair to say, the vegetation in and around the roads. He also focuses on the 1984 maps. The court should understand that the ordinary high water level is the boundary of the DNR public waters jurisdiction. And in this case, the DNR sent an expert surveyor out into the field to determine the ordinary high water level in the vicinity of the violation. He determined the ordinary high water level based on his expert examination of extensive tree evidence. He determined it was 902.9 feet above sea level, and he determined that the fill was below the ordinary high water level. That is sufficient. That proves that these roads are within the DNR's jurisdiction. Now, Mr. Machi responds by focusing on a couple of red herrings. So first of all, he focuses on the vegetation testimony that he gave himself at the hearing and his son gave that did or did not establish itself on the roads. Mr. Machi's argument is inconsistent with the language of the statute. Ordinary high water level is a defined term. It appears in section 103G.005, subdivision 14. It's not where the vegetation is exclusively aquatic, as Mr. Machi suggests. Instead, it's an elevation based on the evidence that nature has left about where the highest water level has been maintained upon the landscape. It's commonly the point where the vegetation shifts from predominantly aquatic to predominantly terrestrial, but it's not where the vegetation is exclusively aquatic. And more fundamentally, there's expert testimony in the record. The DNR did a survey here, determined the ordinary high water level. That proves that these roads are within the DNR's jurisdiction. The second red herring that Mr. Machi raises has to do with the boundaries that are depicted on the 1984 map. Again, the boundaries on those maps are approximate. The maps themselves state that they're in the record at OAH 390, and they were introduced at trial or at the administrative hearing before the administrative law judge. The maps themselves state that the way you determine the ordinary high water level is through an expert survey. That's exactly what the DNR did here. Now, once the court clears out of the jurisdictional issue, whether these roads are within the DNR's jurisdiction, then the question becomes whether there's substantial evidence to support the DNR's determination that Mr. Machi violated the public water statutes and rules. There is substantial evidence in the record to support the DNR's determination. Let me just take a brief step back to explain the regulatory structure and then point the court to the places in the record that show the DNR has met its burden here. So under section 103G.245 subdivision 1, the DNR has permitting authority over work in public waters. Basically, what the statute says is if you're going to place fill or excavate or do other work in public waters, you need a permit from the DNR. Now, pursuant to that statutory delegation, the DNR has adopted certain administrative rules that govern work in public waters. The rule that is at issue here is 6115.0190. That rule does a couple of things. First of all, it identifies certain categories of filling activities that are completely exempt from permitting requirements. The second thing it does is identify the substantive standards that govern when a property owner seeks a permit from the DNR to place fill in a public water. And the other thing it does is identify certain categories of never permissible, always prohibited filling activities. Two are at issue here. So the first never permittable filling activity at issue is you can't place fill to achieve vegetation control. That's subpart 3A of the rule. You also can't place fill in a public water to construct a roadway or pathway or to facilitate land transport across the water. Substantial evidence in the record shows that Mr. Machi violated both provisions of this rule. So with respect to the subpart 3A violation, the vegetation control violation, Mr. Machi stipulated before the hearing, this is in the joint statement of stipulated facts at paragraph 9, that he placed fill on road 1 and road 2 for the purpose of achieving vegetation control. The ALJ also found that he did so. That's at paragraphs 23 and 24 of the ALJ's decision. She cites the underlying documentary and testimonial evidence.
But with regard to subpart 3F, Mr. Earhart says that he was maintaining, that he wasn't constructing. He was just taking care of what was there, as I understand his argument.
I don't think that's a fair characterization of the record, and I certainly don't think it's consistent with the standard of review that applies here. This is not a case about mere maintenance. As I was alluding to in my colloquy with Judge Jessen, the reason the DNR took action here after the Coombe Creek Watershed District notified it of the potential violation is because of new filling activities that Mr. Machi himself engaged in since he purchased the property. The ALJ expressly rejected his argument that this was a mere maintenance case. Machi expressly made a non-conforming use doctrine argument at the administrative level. He's abandoned that on appeal. So this is not a case of just mere maintenance. But the record does show what supports the DNR's determination here is a couple things on the construction facilitate piece. So first of all, on facilitate, if you look at paragraph 9 of the joint statement of stipulated facts, Mr. Machi agreed that he placed fill to facilitate his use of motor vehicles on the roads. I think that's sufficient for the court to affirm the DNR's decision on the subpart 3F violation. On the construct piece, again, I would refer the court to the aerial images and the testimony from the DNR's expert hydrologist that when you look at the 2008 images, you're not seeing any roads, but suddenly you fast forward to 2016 and 2017, you are. And again, that's underscored by the fact that Mr. Machi doesn't dispute that at least with respect to road 1, he retained and consulted with an engineer who specializes in construction in wet areas. And he retained this engineer for the purpose of building a road that wouldn't sink or wash away. And so I think there is absolutely substantial evidence in the record to support both prongs of the 3F violation. So the facilitate prong, again, I think the stipulation in paragraph 9 of the joint statement of stipulated facts is enough. But on the construction, piece as well, and this is what the ALJ found, there's also substantial evidence in the record based on the hydrologist testimony that came in. It's a paragraph 60 through, or excuse me, not paragraphs, pages 60 through 62 of the transcript. It's also reflected in the ALJ's findings. There's absolutely substantial evidence in the record to support that determination here. Let me just address.
Mr. Earhart also raises a more general public policy issue, and that's about the need for landowners to be able to prevent encroachment on their land from expanding public water.
Right.
Do you want to respond to his public policy issue argument?
I would, Your Honor, because I don't want to leave the court with the impression that the DNR is not sensitive to the concerns of private property owners, but there is an equally strong countervailing public interest here, and that's the interest in protecting public waters. The state holds public waters in trust for the public. Now, sometimes public waters do overlap with private property, but that is a countervailing public interest here, one that the state has been exercising control over since the state's founding. The DNR has been responsible for regulating work in public waters for decades now. It has been tasked by the legislature of specifically controlling the types of activities that are at issue here. And so I think there is an equally strong countervailing public policy interest at stake here. And that is the environmental risks posed to public waters from the types of filling activities that Mr. Machi has engaged in. The DNR's administrative rule in subpart one sets out what the overarching goal of the DNR's filling regulations are, and that is to minimize the placement of fill in public waters because that creates environmental risks and harms. That is an equally strong countervailing public policy concern that's implicated by this case, and it should govern here. If I may just very briefly conclude, Your Honor.
You may.
In short, this court should affirm the restoration order issued by the DNR. Throughout these extensive administrative proceedings, Mr. Machi has raised numerous statutional, constitutional, and evidentiary objections to the restoration order. He has not identified a single reason to disturb the agency's decision. The court should affirm the restoration order and order the public water to be restored.
Thank you. Mr. Earhart, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, briefly. One issue that needs to be addressed is relating to the safety valve that Mr. Farrell talked about. That's something new that he's brought up. And in the current instance, there is a procedure for where permits are required of what you have to establish, but that was never offered to the Machis. They said it was prohibited conduct. Now, there's a list of prohibitions, but I did go through there, and it doesn't prohibit keeping a pathway that's used for a fire line or for emergency use as relates to the safety issue. I mean, the Machis are concerned. They live out here. It's reasonable for these landowners to maintain what existed at the time they purchased it. In my, in a summary, it's unreasonable for the DNR to take the position that they can't maintain this property. They're being arbitrary and capricious, and the evidence is unsupported relating to the existence of this road and what it was existed at the time that the Machis purchased it. They relied totally on some aerial photographs that I actually prepared and went over to the county. They don't show at some of the occasions even a path. I mean, these are overhead photographs that are difficult to examine. The actual credible testimony is what's there on the road. And we had live testimony, firsthand testimony from the both Machis that these trails were big enough to support a motor vehicle, a full-size motor vehicle, at the time they purchased the property. They observed in 2009 that the heavy equipment, including water trucks, used these trails. And finally, the last testimony is that both Machis testified that they only brought these paths or roads back to what they had previously existed. The state has none of this information. And more importantly, I asked them in interrogatory, what's the height of these roads? They had no idea. So for them to get up and say that this is a full-blown road, it's made up for purposes of swaying this panel to believe that there was something done more than other than maintenance. I would like to just point out one last thing, and that is this primary and secondary use. Throughout the proceedings, both in before the administrative, the internal, there was a hearing, and that was in 2019, 2020, and before the administrative judge, they made it clear that the primary purposes of maintaining this was for safety reasons. And that was to establish the fire line that they observed firsthand save their house. I look at those prohibitions. There's no prohibitions of doing a fill for safety reasons. Even if, you know, it was public water, why wouldn't the DNR allow a permit so that they could maintain them? When even the public, the fire department came out and used these trails. And lastly, you know, you have to distinguish. I mean, if you have a primary use, which is safety, and it also secondarily helps the recreation, I mean, that's just, you know, a follow-up. So that means you can't do it as a primary for safety, and then it improves secondarily the recreation. That seems to be what Mr. Farrell is speaking. And I lastly is that he bounced around the question when you hit the issue on the head. You know, can you maintain a road that sinks? He comes up with, well, it depends. Well, there's ample support. And in fact, Mr. Farrell Scissors, as he said, safety valves. And this case clearly is a safety valve case. And I ask that you reverse the restoration order and allow this existing road that was constructed and maintained, or that the maintenance work that Mr. Machi done be allowed. Thank you.
Thank you to both of you. Mr. Earhart, I wanted to thank you for your glossary at the beginning of your brief. I found it very helpful, and both of you submitted very good briefs, and the arguments were very helpful to the panel. We will